Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's occasional lecture in the Senate series. Never let it be said that we don't bring you topics that are very topical. Yes? Is that better? I'm very tall. Perhaps if I bend down, if I bend my knees, you might have a better chance. Today's lecturer, we have great pleasure in bringing you Professor Larissa Berendt, who's a woman of great accomplishment for one who's so young. Not only is she Professor of Law, Harvard graduate, prize-winning novelist, widely published writer in many fields. She's also a director of the Bangarra Dance Company and Dance Theatre and a number of other incredible achievements. But today she's going to speak to us about the 1967 referendum, among other things. Our topic is, what did the yes vote achieve 40 years later? So please welcome Professor Larissa Berendt.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to begin by paying my respects to country and acknowledging that we're meeting today on the land of the Ngunnawal people. I'm going to still talk about the 67 referendum, even though I'm going to move on to, I guess, some more topical issues towards the end of the lecture, because in some ways the 67 referendum is a part of why we see Indigenous policy in the situation that it is today. So I'm going to start with a bit of background about that. Obviously, 40 years on is a good chance to reflect on all that's been achieved and hasn't been achieved since that time. And I think when we look at the fact that Indigenous Australians today still have 17 years less life expectancy than their non-Indigenous counterparts, and we see the statistics that many of us here are very familiar with about the disparity between opportunities in relation to education, employment, health and housing, it does give us some pause to ask, well, what do these enormous moments and successes like the 67 referendum do that either helps or hinders us in terms of moving towards achieving social justice for Aboriginal people? Of course, to understand the 67 referendum, we actually have to go back to when the Constitution was drafted to understand what it was that the 67 referendum was trying to fix. And it's well known that at the time the referendum was, the Constitution was drafted, the drafters were working with a few very key but widely held assumptions about Aboriginal people, one of which was that we were a dying race, and there was also an underlying assumption about the superiority of the white races at the time, and we see evidence of that not just in relation to the attitudes held about Aboriginal people at the time, but also by the fact that the first piece of legislation that was passed by the Australian Parliament was the legislation that entrenched the White Australian Policy into law. And I think it's important, if we look at the discussions around the framing of the Constitution and the deliberations about what kind of legal framework we were going to have to govern our country, that by looking under what decisions were made, we actually can come to understand quite a few key assumptions about what sort of society we were going to be creating. One of the very interesting proposals that was put up for discussion by the framers of the Constitution, which came through from the Tasmanian Parliament as part of the process, was to consider a clause within the Constitution that would entrench certain rights that included rights like due process before the law, equality before the law, and some rights around the dealing with of property. And I think it's very instructive that those ideas about having a rights clause were rejected by the framers of the Constitution, because it reveals what they were trying to do in relation to the Constitution. First of all, they rejected those clauses because they did want the capacity very strongly to be able to make laws that were racially discriminatory in relation to Indigenous people and in relation to other groups within the community, particularly the Chinese. So there was a deliberate intention to ensure that this was a legal framework that would allow discriminatory legislation. And another decision that wasn't quite so racially based but does explain a lot about our system of governance was the decision in rejecting putting entrenched rights into the Constitution. There was a strong belief that rather than having a constitution like the American Constitution where rights are entrenched, and the decision about how you protect those rights and what they mean is undertaken by judges. The decision was made to leave the Constitution silent about most rights and to leave the decision-making about what rights we protect and how we protect them and how we value them against other rights to the Parliament, and that that's the place where we as a country put our trust in how those rights are decided. And as you can see, that's been a fundamental hallmark of our Constitution. And that takes us to looking at what the 67 referendum tried to achieve. And from the 1930s, when we saw the emergence of Aboriginal leaders like Fred Maynard and William Cooper, whose advocacy around Indigenous issues really focused on the idea of citizenship rights. The language of equal rights for Aboriginal people had been a very strong part of the campaign for social justice for Aboriginal people. And people like Cooper and Maynard were men who had grown up in circumstances where they had worked on pastoral properties but weren't able to own pastoral land, who had been self-educated, heavily involved in the trade union movement, so involved in politics as well with quite astute political sensibilities, and inherently believed in the idea that if Indigenous people were able to take control of their own lives, were able to run their own pastoral properties, could have control of land, etc., make decisions about their own lives, that was a key part of the agenda for achieving social justice for Aboriginal people. And at the time, a lot of that campaign did focus on the idea of citizenship rights. And so for that reason, it's not surprising that the culmination of a lot of that activism would end up in campaigns that talked about equality for Aboriginal people. And at the time of the referendum, even the posters and the information put out by the proponents of the yes vote was very focused on showing Indigenous children and sort of using the language of this is about providing an equal opportunity for all Australians, and we need to be providing equal opportunity for Aboriginal people. And the language of citizenship rights and equal rights and the idea that this was about equality was very strong in that campaign. And so it's not surprising that there's a lot of mythology about what the 67 referendum actually did. And two of the biggest assumptions about it that are wrong are that it gave Indigenous people the right to vote, or that it was the moment at which Indigenous people became citizens. And in fact, it didn't do either of those things. And in fact, what it did do was it included Indigenous people in the census, and it gave the federal government the power to make laws in relation to Indigenous people. Now, in the lead up to the yes vote, it's very clear that the proponents of the yes vote thought that those two changes would go much further than they actually did. In particular, the idea of including Indigenous people in the census wasn't looked at as simply a body counting exercise. It was believed that if Indigenous people were included in the population in this way, it would start to break down this barrier that had occurred where Indigenous people were treated differently to other members of the community. So there was a belief that inclusion in this way would be a kind of nation-building exercise where we would be incorporating in an imagined community kind of way Indigenous people into the fabric of Australian society. And I think in hindsight, when we look at, say, how debates around something like, say, native title can be so divisive, and the wedge is usually by painting Indigenous people as threatening to the interests of landholders and even being called un-Australian in relation to their attempts to exercise their own property interests. We see lots of instances where I think there's still a psychological terra nullius, if you like, that excludes Indigenous people from being seen as equally part of the Australian community with the same rights. But I think what's important to remember is that that was the aspiration of the people who were advocating for the yes vote in relation to including Indigenous people in the census. And the assumptions made around giving power to the federal government were just as aspirational, but also have been just as usurped as the first change was. It's very clear that the proponents of the yes vote had assumed that by giving the power to the federal government and taking it away from the states, who had for so long abused that power in a way that people had thought had breached on the rights of Indigenous people and hadn't actually been beneficial to them at all, that the federal government would actually move to act in a benevolent way towards Indigenous people. It was the key assumption that they would use that power for the betterment of Aboriginal people when they were given that power. And of course, in hindsight, we've seen lots of instances where that just hasn't been the case. And although we've seen, say, the passing of native title legislation, it's just as easy for that to be repealed, or for legislation that protects rights like the Racial Discrimination Act to be overridden or prevented from operating in relation to specific issues. So there's certainly been a lot of instances we can point to where the federal parliament, in using that legislative power about Aboriginal people, hasn't used it benevolently. And indeed, the extent to which it's required to think of the interests of Indigenous people was tested in the Hindmarsh Island Bridge case. You may remember that the circumstances of that case were that the heritage protection legislation that that operates nationally was prevented through additional legislation from applying to the people of the Hindmarsh Island area, so that they couldn't oppose the building of the bridge. And as part of the argument when this case was heard by the High Court, it was put to the court that they should remember that it was the original intention when that change was made that this was a power that should have been used benevolently. And only Justice Kirby said that you could look at that intention to interpret how the federal government can use that power today. Justice Gaudron said, although that's a nice idea in theory, it just can't hold water in relation to the law as we understand it. And other judges were much clearer about the fact that that intention couldn't be used in the interpretation of how that power is used today, and simply said that if the federal parliament has the power to make that legislation to provide that benefit, they also equally have the power to take it away and to deprive people of that benefit today. And so you can sort of see then how the promise of the 67 referendum and this idea that the yes vote was going to provide a new era of non-discrimination failed to meet the expectations of the people who were the basic proponents of the yes vote, for those reasons that I think that it didn't actually go to underpin some of the very key assumptions that were made about the sort of legal framework our constitution should provide when it was first drafted. And there's a case that I refer to a lot in my work, because I think for Australians, whether they're Aboriginal or not, it's the case that still remains the litmus test of the kind of legal system we have when it comes to how Australia protects basic human rights. And it's the case of Kruger and the Commonwealth, which is the stolen Generations case, the first one that went to the High Court. And in that case, unlike Gunner and Cabillo, which was a case that was argued around tort law and duty of care, the plaintiffs in the Kruger case, who were children who'd been removed in the Northern Territory under the child removal ordinance there, and a parent who'd lost her child under that policy, made out their case on the basis that that policy had breached certain inherent rights that they had, including the right to due process before the law, equality before the law. You'll remember that they were some of the rights that were proposed through the Tasmanian Parliament. Freedom of movement and freedom of religion, which is actually protected in the Constitution under Section 116. And so their basic claim was a claim of the breach of basic human rights. And interestingly, in the way that they brought the claim together was that they didn't rely on any of the rights that we might think were specifically Indigenous rights, but rights that we would think of as applying to all Australians. And they were unsuccessful on every claim that they put forward, including, interestingly, the Section 116 Freedom of Religion Clause, which the court interpreted so narrowly that it didn't apply to their circumstances. And I think that that result gives us a snapshot of the fact that there are so many rights that many Australians might assume are protected somewhere in our legal system that actually have no protection at all, that we're still reliant on the decision about relying on the government to make laws about protecting our rights. And so I think it's a good snapshot of where we stand in that way. But I think it also highlights the fact that where we do see in our legal system this failure to protect rights, it's always going to fall the heaviest on the people who are the most vulnerable, the people who are culturally distinct and the people who have been historically marginalised. And as the experience of the Stolen Generations shows, that is most likely to be Aboriginal people. So those silences have left a big legacy for Aboriginal people, and they've left a legacy for all Australians. And what we can see analysing the 67 referendum post that time is that it didn't actually go to cure some of those fundamental problems that our legal system has in relation to how it protects rights, that whatever the intentions were, that hasn't been the outcome. There's another aspect of the 67 referendum that has profoundly shaped the way in which we deal with Indigenous issues today. And it was, I think, perhaps an unintended consequence. And that was the fact that when that power was transferred through to the federal government as part of the changes to the Races Power, it effectively left responsibility for some of the key aspects of the Indigenous portfolio shared between state and territory governments. So in relation to issues like health, education and housing, there has been a split in the responsibility between those two levels of government. And rather than that relationship since 67 between those two levels of government being one of collaboration and cooperation, it has been one that has been much more characterised by what we understand as cost shifting, where one will try and push the responsibility onto the other level of government, which effectively leaves Aboriginal people underfunded on all of those key areas. We saw, I think, a classic example of this last year in relation to the Northern Territory, when the issue of violence against Indigenous children was raised through the comments of the public prosecutor Nanette Rogers. At that time, the Federal Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, Mal Brough, came out and said what a terrible situation this was, that it was an absolute disgrace, and he pointed the finger firmly at Claire Martin and her government, saying that this is what happens when you don't have enough police and resources put into communities to control these law and order issues. And by painting it as a law and order issue, he was putting that responsibility clearly into the territory and state pocket. But the response of Claire Martin was to come out and say, well, this is a terrible situation. It's absolutely horrible that this is happening. And it's the fault of the federal government, who has consistently underfunded these communities in relation to housing, education, employment and health. And she was absolutely right as well. In fact, they were both right, that both levels of government had been negligent in relation to those areas. And it's been a particularly marked feature of the Indigenous Affairs portfolio in the post-ATSIC era, because when ATSIC was operating, it would be the body that both levels of government would blame when things went wrong, even though it never had responsibility for education and only briefly had responsibility for health. And those two key areas remain federal and state responsibilities through the whole lifetime of ATSIC. You'll be very aware of that simple phrase, well, it's ATSIC's failed, it's ATSIC's fault, ATSIC hasn't done anything. And it became the scapegoat that masked a lot of that government neglect. And in the post-ATSIC era, then it becomes more pronounced that the two levels of government now argue against each other in relation to these issues. You still occasionally hear people saying it's ATSIC's fault, but I think people need to really start taking responsibility for some of those things. So I think that what we've seen as a result of the 67 referendum, as one of its sad unintended legacies, is this issue of cost shifting that's meant that governments have found a way to avoid their responsibility to Aboriginal children. There's another aspect that if we look at those debates around the issue of violence in the Northern Territory when we saw them last year when they rose up in the media as a political football. And that was evident, I think, of one of the other key barriers that we still have to achieving social justice for Aboriginal people. Apart from saying that this was the fault of the Chief Minister that these issues were occurring at such a terrible rate in Aboriginal communities, the other response of the federal government was to very quickly say, we're not going to throw any more money at this issue. That there's things that need to be done, but one thing we're not going to do is we're not going to waste any more money on Indigenous affairs. And I think the fact that that response, that political soundbite, was so quickly accepted by the general community and the media as being an appropriate first step, that the issue wasn't more money and we don't need to think about the funding issues, I think shows how an underlying racism within the Australian community still becomes a really big barrier to achieving social justice for Indigenous people. The social research continues to show us that Australians are increasingly resistant to the characterisation of being racist, especially in their attitudes towards groups like Indigenous people or Muslims. At the same time, the sort of research that we do at UTS, at the centre I work in, often engages in the sort of research where we're often asking Indigenous people to clarify their views about the world. So, for example, we might do research that asks them about what do they mean when they want a treaty, or when they say self-determination, what does that mean? And it never ceases to amaze me that it's almost always the first thing that people in that sort of research will state in terms of their priorities is something about racism or access to services, and not feeling racism in relation to that. And I think that's an interesting observation when you compare that to the fact that many Australians think that racism isn't a problem, that it's still actually one of the things that Indigenous people feels quite defines, whether they're in the cities, in the rural areas or in remote areas, something that quite defines their experiences within the Australian community and how their issues are dealt with. So I think that the challenge in that environment of unravelling and unmasking assumptions like there's too much money thrown at Indigenous people or we don't need to spend more money on these issues becomes a big barrier, because people don't ask the questions about those assumptions that they should. So, for example, if we didn't have such complacency about this issue, and I think that the complacency comes from the fact that that view of Indigenous people getting too much money fits in with the stereotype that's still very prevalent about the extent of welfare dependency in Indigenous communities and the idea that there's a lot of indolence and dole bludging that goes on. If that wasn't masking people's perceptions, they would ask some very clear, hard questions about how much money is being put into Aboriginal affairs. So, for example, the government does always say that we are the government now that puts more money into Indigenous affairs than any government previously, and they're absolutely right. But when they calculate those figures, they include a whole range of issues that don't actually include the money that goes specifically to Indigenous communities. So that would include things like all of the money spent operating the National Native Title Tribunal, all of the money that goes into the processes whereby people are able to, if they're not Indigenous, make claims to protect their own interests in native title claims, which is funded by the federal government. It has included in the past the money spent on litigation like defending the Gunner and Cabillo cases, which runs into the millions of dollars. So you don't see the fact that in relation to what we're told is Indigenous-specific spending, a lot of that money actually isn't about spending to develop capacity and improve Indigenous services. It's about actually processes that relate to Indigenous people but often work against those very two things. And you don't have to scratch the surface very hard to see the evidence of the underspending on the key areas. The Australian Medical Association did a fantastic report in the lead-up to the last election that showed that basic Indigenous health needs were underfunded by $460 million. And work that's been done in the Northern Territory, particularly by the researchers at CAPA, has highlighted enormous underspending in the Northern Territory in relation to education and housing. Some studies have shown that in relation to education in some areas around the Northern Territory, there's only 40 cents spent on the education of an Indigenous child for every dollar spent on a non-Indigenous child. And in the same community that where that research was done, when a shared responsibility agreement was signed with the community and the children were told to send their children to school, the children turned up to find there weren't enough teachers and classrooms, highlighting, I think, the massive underspending on basic infrastructure that we see in some of these communities. So those sorts of clear statistics that we have that show underspending on these key areas of Indigenous health, education and housing get masked when we blanketly accept statements like there's too much money being spent on these issues. We don't see that from the failed policy of shared responsibility agreements that's now being backpedalled from by the federal government. The $100 million first earmarked for it only saw $25 million end up in Indigenous communities, with $75 million being spent on administration. And I think many Indigenous people were asking what sort of questions would have been asked if that had have been the way that ATSIC had have operated when it was doing a program. So there's a whole range of issues that I think come out of the fact that failure to scrutinise Indigenous funding means that many Australians are left asking, why is it that we are spending so much money on Indigenous issues, but still we see no profound change in relation to these key socio-economic areas, where we consistently see in report after report the fact that communities are actually dysfunctional rather than getting better. And I think that that's a really genuine and honest question that Australians ask and should be asking, but the answers that are so clearly there are never put forward because we're given lots of other reasons as to why these things occur. And I think we've seen some really good examples of that recently in the Northern Territory. Again, after decades and decades of reports where Indigenous people have led the discussions about the need to tackle violence in Indigenous communities, where Indigenous women in particular, but Indigenous men as well, have consistently highlighted this as a pressing issue and pointed to a raft of reasons that give rise to these issues, not the least being the importance of dealing with those underlying issues of disadvantage, like health, housing and education. We have never seen any interventions by government that address the blueprints that are clearly set out in report after report. And I think that's been the basic frustration of many Aboriginal people over the heavy-handed interventions that we've seen in the last few weeks. not only is it the fact that these blueprints have been there and this national emergency has been there for decades, not just in the Northern Territory, but in other places around the country, with New South Wales having a report that shows similar levels of violence in some Indigenous communities. There have been, in the light of all of that government failure that I've mentioned before in terms of allocating resources, Indigenous people on the ground who, despite that neglect, have gone on and developed programs in their communities with no resources and no government funding. That's where the initiative for originally having safe houses for women came from. It's where the initiative of having many of those communities become dry communities came from. It was from the communities themselves who have worked in this way. All of that work, the capacity for Indigenous people to try and deal with these issues from inside, gets overridden when we see a paternalistic approach that basically tries to place the blame for these sorts of issues on the Indigenous community. The Anderson and Wild report, like other reports on Indigenous violence, highlighted the fact that many of the perpetrators of sexual abuse against Indigenous people are non-Indigenous people, because like many pedophiles, they're attracted to places where there is dysfunction, because they know where there is dysfunction in the community, there are vulnerable children, and that's where pedophiles find their prey. So it's little wonder that they find themselves attached to communities where there's dysfunction, whether it's in the Northern Territory or whether it's in rural New South Wales, we see that phenomena. There has been nothing in the raft of suggestions that have been put on the table by the federal government that deals with the fact that this is a problem that actually is as prevalent from non-Indigenous perpetrators as Indigenous perpetrators. Instead, we're left with the impression that this is an Indigenous community problem that the Indigenous community has done nothing about, and often it's implied or explicitly said it's a result of Indigenous cultural values that this sort of behaviour takes place. It's been my experience and observation that where we see dysfunctional communities, it's not because Indigenous cultural values are strong and not being moved away from. In fact, it's the exact opposite. It's where Indigenous cultural values, the strong values of reciprocity, kinship, respect for elders, etc., have actually been weathered away and replaced by dysfunction. And I think there is some evidence to support that. If you look in New South Wales at the areas and the communities where there are low crime rates, Indigenous communities, and there are lots of them that have that, you'll find it's where there is the strongest sense of community, and often where the position of women that they've held traditionally in our communities is still strong and respected. So this misinformation about what the underlying issues are and where the cause of the problems are doesn't assist us in relation to dealing with the problem in a long-term way. And you'll notice that none of the solutions put forward by the federal government last week had anything to do with fixing health services, fixing levels of housing, or fixing issues around education. They were all about intervention. And it's true that when there's a crisis, we need forms of intervention. But what the research consistently tells us is that if you want programs to work, just as if you want policies to work, the key aspect in getting that to work is to include Indigenous people in the processes of developing that policy and in implementing those programs into their own communities. That's what the evidence here in Australia tells us works in relation to those programs, and it's consistent in relation to research done on Indigenous issues in North America, particularly in Canada, around issues of health. It's the stark deficiency of the approach of the federal government last week that without any consultation with the Indigenous communities affected, these were programs, punitive programs, that were set down for them, with the only consultation being with an Indigenous leader in Cape York who was not connected with those communities. And it's really easy to see why those communities in the Northern Territory felt frightened by the changes and felt as though this was something that had been imposed on them and they were being punished. I think the further concern about the approach is that of the interventions that were proposed, they're fairly punitive in what they do, and a lot of them are being done without the resourcing behind them to make them effective, or they're clearly policy directions that don't work. So, for example, we know for a fact that if you prescribe prohibition in a community, it won't work, and that's true whether it's a black community or a white community. It's only been effective where it's been trialled with the consent of the community agreeing to have those sorts of situations in place. We see one of the other interventionist measures that's being proposed is the tying of welfare payments to school attendance, when we've already had the experience in Wadi that there aren't enough teachers and classrooms to accommodate children. And further, the concerns around the mandatory testing, which originally was testing to see if children had been sexually abused on the first day. That's what the proposal was. There was concern about issues of privacy and consent. But additionally, there was concerns raised by the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association that there weren't enough doctors to perform or resources to perform those sorts of tests. And questions seriously being asked about why the government can have this sort of interventionist measure when for decades we've been saying there's an enormous underspending on basic Indigenous health needs and have been highlighting the need to continue to put resources into Indigenous community health services. The next day they were told that these were only health tests, which still didn't give any indication of how these things were going to be resourced, or did it explain how, if you did find health or issues of abuse, what resources were being put in terms of counselling or further health treatment for that. And then the next day people were being told that these tests wouldn't be mandatory. And I think that really highlights the fact that this was policy on the run. It made it incredibly difficult for Indigenous communities to respond to and obviously made them very angry and very confused. I think the bottom line is, and I'll finish with this point, is that it's just another exercise in showing how it is one of the key problems with this federal government's approach to Indigenous issues. And they're not unlike other governments in relation to this, but their key strategies around Indigenous issues and how they deal with it have never been led by what the research says or what the reports say. There are numerous reports, we all know that. They say similar things and they give similar blueprints about what people working on the ground in these issues say need to be done. They're consistently overlooked, and even at a time when the government says that it's acting because it feels there's an emergency, all of those recommendations are overlooked. Instead of looking at the research and looking at what we know works and looking at programs that have been developed in communities that do work but actually often end up being defunded or not funded to move into other communities, we see approaches that are led by ideologies. And they're the ideologies of assimilation, they're the ideologies of mainstreaming, they're the ideologies of mutual obligation. And that's what the drivers in Indigenous policy have been. And that's why I think people are so concerned about it, because the last time these were the drivers in Indigenous policy, we ended up with bad policies and bad results. There's nothing in the application of this new kind of paternalism that shows any reflection about why this was a policy initiative that failed the last time to give us any indication of why it might be different this time. There's actually no indication or any evidence that these approaches are going to work. And most frustratingly, they work counter to what we show, to what the evidence shows actually works, that this top-down push to assimilation, push to mainstreaming, works against that very important research that says to make a difference in the lives of Indigenous people, we need to be working with Indigenous people to build solutions from the ground up that are going to be effective. We need to be taking a leadership on Indigenous issues that means that we're actually bringing people along with us, not dictating us to them. And that's why I think we see so much evidence of the continual failure of Indigenous policy and so much scepticism from the Indigenous community about why all of these supposedly new approaches are going to work. All of that's fairly grim, and I don't pretend it's not. In fact, I've been particularly disheartened by the fact that I think Labor is as unable to critically analyse what is wrong with these approaches in a way that many people on the ground could have told them was inherently and obviously wrong with them. I think they've made it clear that it's much more important to be seen, to be taking an approach that's about appeasing the concerns of the same sector of the electorate that John Howard is so concerned to impress, rather than using this as an opportunity of building trust and faith and a new vision with the Indigenous community, and I'm incredibly saddened by that. And it doesn't give me much hope that if we simply have a change of government that things will be better. I would need to see a lot more evidence of some real thought about different approaches before I would be confident of that. But to take us back to the 67 referendum, I think that's where we do get a sense of hope from. There's no doubt that a lot of these policy directions that have been so detrimental to Aboriginal communities have occurred as a result of an increasing conservatism within the Australian community that comes from a whole raft of pressures, whether it's the economic insecurity that now sees people value interest rates as an election issue over human rights, or whether it's our the fear that's been bred about the war on terror and our fear of outsiders and our fear of people who are different to us. In that climate of extreme conservatism, it's easy to forget what the real magic of the 67 referendum was. And that was that 90.77% of Australians voted yes. And they voted yes because they thought that by voting yes, they were going to give Aboriginal Australians a better chance at a life within Australia and were going to be given the capacity to be able to live in Australia at a standard that wouldn't make us ashamed. And I think that that's a really important moment to hold on to, because it's not often in our history that non-Indigenous Australia has actually understood that its fate is tied to the fate of the Indigenous community. And Gough Whitlam once said, it's the standard by which everyone else will judge us, how we treat Indigenous people, and I think that's really true. And I don't think it's just a matter of how other people would judge us. I think it's really a matter of how we judge ourselves as a society. If we think that it's okay that laws are working and policies are working because middle-class white Australia is doing okay, then that surely can't be the test. We need to be actually evaluating what kind of society we are by how well we do by the people who are less fortunate, who are historically marginalised, who are culturally distinct, who are severely socioeconomically disadvantaged. How they fare under our laws, our policies and our constitution is actually how we're going to be judged as a society. And at the end of the day, I think it's how John Howard and Mal Brough will be judged too. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Larissa, for that grim, thought-provoking but also inspiring lecture. I believe you're happy to take questions. If people have questions, and let them be questions, could you come to the microphones in the centre and up in the gallery? Yes, we have a questioner at the front here.
John Altman from CAPER. Thanks a lot, Larissa. Much of what I think I was hearing you say was about media responsibility for holding governments accountable. And when I listened to you, it reminded me that since self-government in the Northern Territory, the Commonwealth has retained responsibility in relation to outstations, communities of less than 100 people, of which there are more than 500 in the Northern Territory. And it seems to me that the mainstream media hasn't picked up this issue at all, that the government is, the federal government, in a very centralist way, is now going into 62 communities in the Northern Territory with a population of more than 200, which are Northern Territory government responsibility. But besides Amanda Vanstone's reference to outstations as cultural museums at the end of 2005, the whole issue of outstations, which Amanda Vanstone was also presenting as the remote outpost of paedophilia, which is why she was suggesting these cultural museums should be closed down. We haven't heard anything from the media about outstations. So I guess I was just going to really invite you to comment on that. You know, why aren't we hearing from the mainstream media about those places that have been a Commonwealth responsibility since 1978 under the Memorandum of Understanding between the Commonwealth and the Northern Territory Government? And is this just again an example of media slackness in relation to Indigenous people?
Well, I can't begin to second guess the media because I'd hurt my head. But you know, I think you raise a really interesting issue. I think there's obviously, as you've said, Australians get their information from the media, and the media is lazy. It'd be interesting to see how many actually knew of the issues of outstations and those you know, those nuances around where responsibility lies. And we can see just when we look at budget figures and blanket statements that they're not unpacked, let alone how people, you know, start to think about the more sophisticated issues. Often the Indigenous Affairs section in many newspapers is the section given to the newer journalists, and I know that many people working in the room who work in the area, like myself, often get journalists who are new, starting in the area, who want to know what the stories might be that they can cover. So there's certainly a sense that people are kind of, you know, finding their feet in this portfolio. And having said that, there are other newspapers that clearly run strong campaigns with a very firm editorial view about Indigenous issues, and that's always going to cloud their perspective. And sometimes the general community isn't able to discern as sophisticatedly what's an editorial line and what's fact, because they don't have the facts in front of them themselves. And the education system is probably as complicit in that as the media is, because it makes the general community unable to ask the right questions, and it's what produces the journalists. But you actually reminded me of a very interesting thing when you were talking about the outstations, because they've of course had their own attack, as you've said, the cultural museums thing, and it's kind of one of the ironies of the way that the government's run its campaign against Indigenous communities, that not so long ago there was a campaign through the federal government and through right-wing think tanks to close down those remote areas, basically saying that if people chose to live in these remote areas, then they couldn't expect the same level of services that other Australians could, and that they were economically unviable, and we had to think about that. And I was sort of reminded of that when Clive Hamilton made the comments about the continual drought assistance being bad policy, and saying, look, it's just bad public policy to be continually giving money to people who might actually be engaging in bad farming practices. And that the response from Canberra was to basically say, how dare somebody attack our farmers? You know, this is a part of the Australian ethos that we need to protect. And Clive Hamilton had to confess that there's something more about farmers than just economic issues or economic rationalist arguments as to why we think they're an important part of the Australian community. But at the same time as those debates about the outstations were going on, we didn't hear any politicians in Canberra saying, no, hang on a minute, it's a really important part of the Australian culture and history to have had, you know, this aspect of Aboriginal culture. It's important to protect it, and there's more than just economic arguments here. In fact, rather than putting forward that sort of view, we were, as you pointed out, being told that, you know, these are dysfunctional communities where pedophilia is rife. So nobody made any public statements as to why they should be protected, whether it was on economic terms or otherwise. So, you know, I think you're right to highlight the fact that this latest assault is just one in many assaults, and it's similar to what I think is the other large assault on Indigenous issues that's being in a way a bit clouded by this. At the same time as the government's putting this pressure on the Northern Territory, on these specific communities, they're pulling out a large amount of resources from the southeast, which is a continuation of the fact that they have been removing resources from the southeastern parts and the southern parts of Australia in key areas like housing and the Work for the Dole programs, which in some areas are the only form of employment where there's no workforce. And that's being done rather silently, but with stealth and with complicity by the state governments. The largest Indigenous community in Australia is in Mount Druitt, and it's in danger of losing all of its social housing money. And, you know, I think the pity is that we're going to be looking at the social and economic outcomes of these bad policy decisions in 10 and 20 years from now. So more cheery news. Thanks for that, John. Cheered us all up.
Do you mean to say we only have one question?
We can always rely on you, sir.
Thank you. As you were talking, I couldn't resist one part of the thing. You are an American.
No, I'm not.
I'm not anti-American. I understand from your introduction. Harvard?
No, I studied there. I'm Aboriginal, actually.
Thank goodness. I thought, dear, oh dear, we're going to have an Aboriginal and we have a white person. You're Aboriginal. Original. Isn't that magnificent?
I fool people because I dye my hair blonde. It's been a source of great concern for Andrew Bolt.
No more disclosures.
Yeah.
Now, we're in a question of perception.
Yeah.
When I came in here, I started to object to that. I'm not a Sydney-sider. And I'm saying, why isn't Tasmania up there so it can play football in Melbourne? That's our perception. I'm not a Sydney-sider. So I'm thinking to myself, what else has been lost in our perception? Now, there's a group that gets 900 million of our taxpayers' money to talk to us every night called the ABC. Now, what about a hand camera going to Western Australia and going through each of the and saying, Western Australia, you've had nearly two centuries, then up to Queensland with this, it's perception that we need, and when that's rubbed in night after, and you told me something about New South Wales, but what about Victoria? And it's silence. And there'll be a few others that'll come to your mind now. We have 900 million of our taxpayers' money, and we don't even see a picture night after night after night until it's rubbed into us. Our disgrace is such that how can we ever overcome it?
Thank you. Larissa, I thought that was a magnificent speech, and how you can give a speech like that without saying once is formidable.
I didn't even read my notes.
I know, I was watching.
I think I bought the wrong speech, but anyway.
My question involves Noel Pearson. When I saw Howard on Late Line, I felt that his presentation and the announcement of his intervention smacked of Pearson. And I wonder whether you can talk about the paternalism of the Howard intervention and perhaps what appears to me to be a strong paternalism in the Pearson approach and what that means for Aboriginal leadership in Australia, because I think many, many white people look at Pearson and he's pretty impressive, but I suppose my preference is for Mick Dodson, Pat Dodson, but how does that get communicated to the Australian people?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question, isn't it? You know, and there's a very strong protocol within the Indigenous community that we still respect, and I think Noel's been the beneficiary of this for a long time, that we don't think it's appropriate for us to attack each other publicly, that it creates a wedge, it allows for our opponents to make us weak if we're seen as fighting amongst each other. And often the press are very keen to get sound bites from one Indigenous leader attacking another. They seem to think that makes good sport. And it's true that, you know, there were 500 different Indigenous languages in 1788, and I think, especially in the post-ATSIC era, Indigenous politics and leadership is very regionalised. And what works in the Murdipaki region in New South Wales is different to what will work in Alice Springs, and it's different to what will work in Cape York, and the leadership is different. And I don't think that that's a view that many Australians see, because they don't see that side of how Indigenous communities work and operate. You know, Noel's had a very strong view about what direction we should be taking in Indigenous affairs, and he has put that very strongly. It's true that he has enjoyed unprecedented contact with the federal government and the opposition as well in relation to being able to have opportunities to express his views about what should happen, and they've engaged in that in a way that has frustrated many other Aboriginal people who are just as experienced at working in their own communities about these issues and what works, but don't have the privilege of being able to have that access to influence. And I think that that frustration from their part is understandable. It's a protocol within the Indigenous community that you should not tell other Aboriginal groups what they should be doing. And so, and you would have seen press releases from people within the Northern Territory expressing their concern that Noel has in the past allowed his work and now quite vocally saying that his approach should be used there and being very unapologetic about breaching that protocol. I think that's been another source of criticism from within the Indigenous community. He's never gone to visit them. I think it's been also an increasing source of frustration from the people that I've spoken to in the Territory over the last week and a half that it's well known on the public record that Malbrough phoned Noel Pearson before implementing these changes. I spoke to women in Alice Springs 2 hours after the government made the announcement and they didn't know anything about it. And that sort of process goes against all of our cultural protocols and people get very angry about it, especially when they feel that what has been imposed upon them against their will and without their consent is not what they think will actually work. And there is, I think, a growing concern about that. But it's a concern that I think has been in the Indigenous community and has been brewing amongst people working on Indigenous areas for some time. But I can't tell you how many people say to me, gee, I like Noel Pearson, he's so impressive, he's so articulate. And when I ask them, well, what is it about what he says that you like so much, they're often really hard-pressed to tell me. And I wonder how much racism there is when people think an articulate Aborigine, what a role model.
Up to the gallery.
Thank you, Larissa, very much for your excellent presentation. I'm wondering what you might see as a sort of a justification, for the sake of argument, for the, say, remote Aboriginal places and or settlements and the or and some of the less remote ones. I can think, for instance, that they could be very valuable if people get who are travellers get lost and they might come across Aboriginal settlements which would redirect them to safety. But I wondered if you have if you could sort of summarise a conceptualisation that would in the eyes of we white or we sort of ordinary non-Aboriginal Australians would be help to present a convincing or an argument for the maintenance of remote settlements.
Well, I think that there are a whole raft of them. There's actually some research that shows, and John would be more familiar with some of the details of this, that shows that where people do have access to their own land in that way, they actually enjoy improved health and other well-being aspects, so less suicides, etc. There's actually a strong correlation between people having the capacity to live on traditional land and their health outcomes. So if you're looking for cold, hard research and economics, there's a whole lot of stuff in that. But, you know, we have a really large country and people live in all parts of it, black and white. And in the past, we've been really inventive about how non-Indigenous people have lived in remote parts of this country. You know, we had flying doctors, we had radio schools. When people talk about these remote outstations, they seem to somehow lose all of that creativity in terms of how you can actually, in innovative ways, support people's choices about where they want to live without depriving them of their basic human rights, without saying, well, if you want to live in these areas, we don't have to provide you with education and health services. We see lots of examples where non-Indigenous people in Australia choose to live in very remote places and we don't abandon them in the way that we do Aboriginal people. And I think that sometimes comparing those situations can start to make us realise that there's something more in how we make that value judgment than simply somebody's choice. It has a lot to do with their cultural background and the colour of their skin. Thanks.
Our time is actually up, I'm afraid, so I'd like you to join me in thanking Professor Berendt for a very thought-provoking.
Thank you. So I haven't learned anything about the paper because I don't know what I did. But I may be able to put something together.